Okay. You were at Sharpendom, Merck Sharpendom. There was a merger someplace along the way, I gather.
52.
Talk about life as a special librarian / documentalist, and tell me which one of those terms you identified with most readily.
Okay, I just read this the other day when I was boning up for you. I was called the librarian the whole time, and then there were other librarians at Merck also. There were about three or four libraries altogether, but I was the librarian at West Point still. West Point is the local place, which is now the main plant. Ballway, New Jersey had been the main plant right after the merger. I would talk to my bosses about all this new stuff, and Mort Taub came one time and talked to them. And he had a great influence. I mean, Mort Taub and I did not agree on hardly anything forever.
Oh, yeah.
But we were friends in spite of it.
Yeah, I want to come back and let's talk about that more later.
Yeah. And so when I would talk to my boss about it, I would talk about documentation and all the, you know, words that were being thrown around, information retrieval, all these words. And eventually, along about 1953 or 54, he introduced me to somebody and said, "This is our documentalist." And I got a kick out of that because it showed that times were a change, and that he thought that was a more complimentary term than librarian.
Yeah.
And that's my story. It's all wrapped up in that. But special librarians at the time, and I was active in the local Philadelphia SLA, divided themselves into two groups, the ones who were and the ones who weren't interested in documentation. I mean, it was still looked on as...
Even within the special library?
Yeah, with a certain amount of contempt by the people who weren't interested in this newfangled stuff with punch cards and all that. So that was the atmosphere at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a foot in both camps?
Sure.
Pretty well?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, I considered myself among the avant-garde in that. And Drexel was still pretty contemptuous of documentation. You know, they weren't interested until I went to lunches where the dean of Drexel was also attending, and a couple of times he sat opposite me at the table and we'd yuck about this newfangled stuff, and he was interested. And I said, "Well, you ought to give a course in it. And there are a lot of people who need courses." And he said, "Well, what would be in it, and who would I get to teach it?" So we talked about that over a period of a couple of months.
Now, this is a different dean,
This is a different dean. This is the one I got along with, probably the only one in history.
This guy Garrison?
No, his name was... No, Garrison's on the bad list. John Harvey was the dean.
Oh, right, okay.
At that time. And so eventually, he got to the point where he said, "Don't tell me I should give that course." I mean, when we sat down at the table, he said, "Don't tell me I should give that course. I can't get any of those people you suggested to teach it. And the only person who could teach it is you. Now, either you're going to come and teach the course, or we're not going to talk about it anymore." And I said,
this
okay.
This is 63 or 62.
This is 62, early in 62. And I didn't say anything more at the lunch about the course. And he had given me his ultimatum, and that was it. And I didn't want to teach it. And I didn't consider myself a teacher. I thought I would be awful at teaching. But thought about it, and darn it, that course should be given, and I know what should be in it, and maybe I could teach it, so why don't I try it? So we set up a summer course that took people away from their jobs for 6 weeks to come take the course full time. They live in Philadelphia, and they just come every day, and all day long we have a course.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who came, I think there were 12 in the course. I have the list somewhere.
Yesterday. This was in 63 now.
No, it was 62.
62.
And I was president of ADI at the time, and I had all sorts of responsibilities and was busy. But I taught this darn course, which, you know, takes a lot out of you, 6 weeks of 8 hours a day, and then you have to come home and correct papers and prepare for the next day and all that. But I put everything I had into it, and The students were mostly very interested and, you know, devoted to it and were putting their time into it and with the same sort of vigor. And at the end of the course, one of the guys got a $2,000 raise for having taken the course, which made me feel good. And another guy left altogether because he couldn't be away from his job for 6 weeks without being missed too much. And they said they didn't want him to come back. But he got a much better job instead because he'd had the course and so on. So that was encouraging enough. I thought, well, that justifies giving the course, and it should be given regularly in the curriculum at Drexel. And until then, nobody but Western Reserve had given a course in documentation. And that was had been going on for about 2 years now. Jesse Scheer, I was responsible for that. So I talked with him about it and said, what do you think? And he said, of course. They should have a course in information retrieval. And so Harvey was very pleased with the way the summer course had gone. And I said to him, do you want me to teach it this fall? And he said, you would? And I said, yeah. And so we set it up. Mm-hmm. I taught the first, I changed it. It was only one evening a week all year. Mm-hmm. And taught pretty much the same material. And that had a very good enrollment, and the students were all enthusiastic about it. And so it went on from there. We started building a curriculum so that other people could teach.
Now I read someplace Drexel calls itself as starting an information science program in 63.
60? Oh, okay.
Or
it was
someplace along
the fall of 62, 63, so...
Okay. Were you at the conferences at Georgia Tech?
Yeah.
Where they talked about the that? Okay.
Dr. Harvey and I went together to that.
Okay. Uh-huh. And I believe it was Robert Taylor talks about in his little article in the 1976 bicentennial issue, talks about Drexel starting what they called an information science program in 63. Mm-hmm. And so your course was...
That was my course that started it, yeah. I mean, mine was the only course that first year, and then, it wasn't maybe a curriculum because it was a single course in 62, and then by 63 there was a curriculum.
And so there was your course, and what else was being taught, do you recall?
I'd have to think about it to tell you. There wasn't very much. I got interested right away in teaching a research course to these same students so they'd be able to write a thesis. Because at that point, to get a master's degree, you could write a thesis on cookbooks or on children's literature or something like that and get a degree. But there was no way to write a thesis on subjects of information retrieval unless you could get money, first of all, to support doing some work that you could write a thesis about. And that you also knew the right techniques. You had scientific method in mind. And so it wasn't the first couple of years that I was at Drexel, but starting fairly soon, I think it was the third year, I took on counseling master's degree students and helped them write theses. And then a year after that, or some such time, they were starting a doctoral program. And people who were taking courses in the doctoral program were just floundering. They were getting nowhere and paying every year for this for the thesis fee that they had to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not getting them anywhere. And they couldn't even get a proposal accepted, most of them. And so everybody was in a funk about it. And I told Dr. Harvey that we had to have a research course. And he said, well, what would that be, and how could you teach that? How can you teach anybody to do research? And I said, I think I know, because I've just been through it with Dick Orr, and he taught me. And so I think I could teach it to other people. And so he said, well, try it. And so I tried it, and two of the people, and I think there were 10 people took the course, and two of them got their proposals funded. Mm-hmm. At the end of the course.
Mm-hmm. Now this is 63, 64, along in there.
It was later than that, I believe. Okay. 64, 65, something. I'm not sure the dates. I could, if I had my collection, I could answer your question, but I can't look things up. So I know that the research course was an important one. And then Belver Griffith came there from that psychological association. Mm-hmm. Do you know the name Belver Griffith? Well, I thought, because my boss thought a lot of him, that he was going to be a great teacher. But it turns out that he's too retiring. His personality didn't seem to fit the student body. I'll just leave it like that. Mm-hmm. And I told him the first year he came that he could teach the research course, or I wouldn't take more than 20 students in the course, because it just, the workload was just not amenable to teaching if you had more than 20 students who needed guidance at every step of the way. And I didn't like to lecture to more than 20 students at any time, because I wanted to ask them questions and have them respond. I didn't lecture. I never wrote on the blackboard and had them take notes. I distributed any notes I thought they needed, and then we talked about things in class. And a few people told me I wasn't teaching when I did that. But most people liked it very much, because it made them think. So anyhow, I told Belver he could... I knew Belver through Dick Orr, and I told him when he came there that he could teach one part of the research course and I'd teach the other part, because more than 20 students had registered. That was it. That we just split the number down the middle, and he'd take half and I'd take half. And he liked that idea, and I gave him my syllabus. And within 4 weeks, all the students were in my class. They were a bad and a good experience.
Yeah. And were you full-time teaching? Considered yourself, you were still just doing...
I was just doing it in my spare time at night.
I thought that was right, but you were never really full-time at Drexel.
No, not at all.
Let's go back to the 50s period, this early 50s period. Again, on the special librarian versus documentalist, because this interests me. You've probably heard this phrase that was used very condescendingly by some special librarians, that documentation was special library work done by amateurs.
Yeah.
Well,
it was true that a number of the people who were documentalists had come from the sciences,
right,
or from administration even, but had never had an experience in libraries.
But I gather this was a phrase used very condescendingly toward those science people.
There was a definite intellectual fight between conventional librarians and the newfangled type.
Between those with and without training, or
no?
How would you describe that?
It's true that a number of people who made good contributions were without library school training, and that librarians frowned on their work because they hadn't been trained as librarians. They thought they were coming in through the back door and approaching things backwards and upside down and so on, but coming to the same conclusions that those trained in library science came to in the end. I mean, they might fumble a bit and do it differently, and the doing it differently was sometimes better than the old way of doing it. It depended on your point of view or how it came out in the end. But yeah, there was a definite, and I was in the middle of that because I was both. And I was discriminated against a considerable amount. But that didn't bother me. I was sort of proud of it.
I gather the scientists who came into the field said, "You librarians haven't been doing this right, because don't understand the subject matter."
No, they never said that. They just said, "I think I have a brand new way to do something, and I'd like you to do it that way too. I want to teach it to you." And the librarians could see that it was things that they'd thought about, in some way before, and that these guys were doing it just a little differently. Mm-hmm. But the guys didn't understand.
Would you say if one side had a weakness, what was the other? Just say, let me not answer the question for you, but to prompt you. What's always struck me is that librarians, generally speaking, didn't come with the subject background.
That's right.
And that this caused a real weakness in doing information retrieval work.
Right. That's the advantage that the information retrieval specialist, the documentalist, had over the librarians.
And you, with both of these, with a good chemistry background, and with the library training.
The experience at Sharp and Dome to teach me how scientists did ask questions. And so, yeah, I felt that I had, you know, an overview of the whole thing.
What did this do to you personally, and politically, too?
It made me thumb my nose at people who didn't approve of me. And I just went about doing my business, which I thought was the way to go.
But you seem to have gone the ADI side more than the SLA side.
Because SLA was not interested, even the pharmaceutical librarians within SLA were not interested in punch card techniques.
Oh, they weren't?
No. I mean, a few, but in general they weren't. Mm-hmm.
So you generally found very little reception for these ideas within SLA?
Well, I considered myself a missionary, and missionaries don't always get well received, but I would give papers and stuff, and I would get crowds. Mm-hmm. And people listened to me. They might not approve, but they'd come and listen because they didn't want to miss out on it altogether.
Mm-hmm.
That was that general attitude.
There was a considerable feeling within SLA against the documentalists, and particularly you're aware of the continuing discussions about the two groups trying to merge. Where did you stand on those?
Pete Loon was the one who was the most interested of anybody in this merger of the two, and Gene Jackson of IBM. He was at the car manufacturer by that time.
At GM,
General Motors. Gene Jackson was a straddler of the two camps, too. He was a librarian, but he was interested in the new stuff. And Pete, of course, who was not a librarian at all, but he saw that there was a lot in common between what librarians did and what documentalists did. He didn't have any prejudices about that. And so the two of them did some of the original maneuvering to get the two groups together, because Gene Jackson was a leader within SLA, did I say that? And Pete was now a leader within ADI. I got in on it very early on, too, because Pete and I talked about all kinds of things. I joined the movement toward doing it. And we were going to try to accomplish it in one way through having a joint newsletter that we would put together. And I was helping Pete. Pete was getting pretty sick by that time. It was early 64. I started helping to put together this newspaper with his guidance, and we had the first issue just about ready to go at the time he died, and so we went ahead and published that one issue, and that's when the issue was about published.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And G. Jackson got sick too and stopped pushing, and everybody just sort of stopped pushing, and then the whole thing fell apart. Nothing ever really came of it.
So you were in favor of the merger?
Oh, yeah. I could see that it was very valuable for us all to join forces rather than fight with one another.
Who was against it within ADI?
Within ADI? I don't know that anybody was. They were disinterested, but I don't think they were against it.
Mm-hmm. You felt that the opposition was more within SLA?
Yeah, the opposition was within SLA. Yeah. And there were some SLA members who were members of ADI, of course.
Right. But I've looked at some numbers, and there was about a 60%. 60% of the ADI members also belonged to SLA in about 1963, at the time you were president. Like you, you belonged to both,
right,
I gather,
right,
for all of these, or for many years anyway.
Yeah, and there was good reason to belong to both. It was valuable for me, too.
But there were animosities, particularly from which side?
Well, from the less technical-minded SLA people. I don't know of any animosity within ADI. As I said, there might have been disinterest, but not, I don't think, animosity toward SLA. Except they might have, you know, most people thought it was coming down a notch to associate yourself as, I mean, you know, to identify as a librarian. You wouldn't want to do that.
That feeling strong within ADI.
Within ADI, yeah.
Did you have to defend librarians when you were within ADI?
If it ever came to that, I would defend them, yeah. Mm-hmm. But usually that was not a topic.
Not within ADI.
No. We let the darn fools do what they want to do with the attitude.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, this period has interested me particularly. I have a paper coming out in that special issue of JASIS that we've done one part on, and that the second part is coming out on the relationship
in the newsletter. JASIS. It is JASIS.
And,
okay. I saw it.
The relationship between the special librarians and the documentalists in this period.
Yeah, well, if I sat down and thought about it more, I could probably think of instances of things that happened on both sides, but at the moment it's not on the top of my head.
Back to the 53 meeting at Johns Hopkins. You say this was your first acquaintance with Mortimer Taube.
Yeah, first time I ever heard of him.
And let's talk about, you said you all were good friends but didn't agree with each other on much.
Yeah, I don't know that we were good friends, but we were good acquaintances. Mart used to, and he had no money at all, but nobody knew that. He'd keep it a big secret. He'd give meetings at every SLA, he'd give parties at every SLA meeting and spend a great deal of money taking a lot of people to dinner and buying them drinks and fancy desserts and all kinds of things, and not knowing if he was going to be able to get out of the hotel when it came time to pay the bill. And I was one of the party girls. I mean, most everybody was male that he entertained, or that he wanted to entertain, and he needed a few women there. And for some reason, he liked me in the sense of being a friendly person or something. And so he would ask me, so I'd come talk to all these men, with all these men who I was trying to get interested in documentation and information retrieval, because they were the money men from the various companies and so on. And so I always got invited to all these parties. And I made up the term party girl. I was never a typical party girl. But I got to meet a lot of people by going, so I would go. And the food was always good and all that. And then Mort took on the role of being of a father figure for me. He was worried that these guys would flirt with me, and he'd try to keep anything undesirable from developing. And I can remember him, you know, going and telling some guy that he couldn't do such and so, that I was a married woman. And I couldn't quite understand why he wouldn't have this father figure image, but he did. And so in those regards, and then we were always bumping heads at various things that Rem Rand was interested in sending me to as a representative of what they might perform, a service they could perform, and Taub would be there too. A typical example was Astia. Taub had gotten in there first and had computer terms established and had this dictionary that was so big that it was completely unmanageable, but he would say so, and he didn't dare say so in his presence, or he'd really get ripped out, but he knew it too, that it wasn't workable, and because the whole inverted way of going at subject headings at that time was not the way to go, and I was preaching the opposite gospel, and so we were in a sense at loggerheads with one another, but yet we couldn't dislike one another. We had this somewhat distant but yet friendly relationship.
Well, I gather you were not a fan of the uniterm approach.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. I preached the other approach.
Which was?
The not inverted.
The not inverted.
Yeah.
The unit record approach.
Yeah, the unit record approach.
Was this a result of working with the IBM system and doing it that way?
Yeah, I came to believe that if you didn't have such an awful lot of cards to handle, and tried to build, get everything into one card so you could coordinate everything with everything, that it was a much easier world to live in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those two distinct approaches, and particularly keeping in mind that I think I would describe, I don't know how you could describe it better than I, but I would describe that the inverted approach is what won as we got faster processing machines.
Yeah, it works better now because of fast processing. And so that,
but for the time...
At that time, it was...
What led you to favor one over the other? Again, is it because of what you were doing with the IBM 101?
Or? Yeah, I think so. It's the way I grew up with the problem, and it was working very well with the 101, and so I tended to go that direction. After we got into fast machines, they still weren't fast enough at Medlars and so on during that period to want to convert. If I were as active now as I had been then, I might very well change hands.
And so in the Medlars approach, you still went with the unit record approach.
Right. And so did everybody. I mean, all the people I knew at Medlars were on that side of the fence, too. At the National Library, I should say.
Well, before we talk specifically about your research in that area, I want to... go to the experience working with Remington Rand. This is 58 to 61.
Yeah.
Well, wait, before we get there, I'm sorry, I need to talk about Garfield, because you were there in 1957. I gather what you left Merck Sharp and Dohme and couldn't start to work at Sperry Rand.
Another one of those pregnancy complications.
Okay. Was there a dean at at Sperry Rand?
No, but there was a personnel department. And Moxley had hired me, because I said to him when he called me on the phone, I wrote a letter both to him and to Pete Lynn and said, I'm going to look for a new job, but I'm pregnant, and so they're about a 6-month period during which I can look and we can talk about these things. Do you think you'd like to hire me? And both Pete and Lockley said yes, but Pete wrote me, I don't know, he phoned me or something much later on and said, are you sure you want to do this? And so on. But meanwhile, Lockley got my letter and called me the same night and said, you're hired. And I said, well, not so fast. I told you I'm pregnant. And I don't think I ought to change until the end of the pregnancy, because first of all, I have good medical coverage at Sharp and Dohme, and I shouldn't want to lose that. And he said, I don't care about your belly. I just care about your head. Come on. And so he said, I'll see that you get insurance coverage. And so I went. And he said, I'll even hire a husband, bring him along, and we'll have an interview. And so my husband went along, and they wanted him to write for them. And when he heard the story, he wasn't interested. He didn't want to write technical stuff.
Right?
And so that fell by the wayside. But a week or two later, that went on for all day. He was just